The book Nook on WISO is presented by the Greene County Public Library with additional support from the Clark County Public Library, Washington Centerville Public Library, Wright Memorial Library, Dayton Metro Library, and Microsun Lamps.
Hello, welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and I'm thrilled to have Joe Ede back on the program. Hello, Joe.
Hi, Vic. Nice to be back.
You know, Joe, this is the third time we've had you on the show, and I have fond memories of our first interview because you had just written the first novel in what has become a series featuring a guy named IQ, and the book had just come out, and you were pretty much unknown, weren't you?
Yeah, I was completely unknown. Yeah. It was my first book, and I came out of the blue, and that the book was, you know, got read by people at all was a surprise. I had very low expectations for the first book.
Well, I love the first book, and then I love the second book, and now I love the third book, and apparently I'm not alone.
The reviewers have been very kind.
Two write-ups in the New York Times in the last 2 weeks, Joe, before the book even came out. I mean, come on.
It was stunning. It was. These things continue to astound me.
Uh-huh.
My own experience of the book is sitting at my desk in my pajamas, typing, eating tacos, drinking coffee, and talking to my dog. That's how I experience the book. So when something like, you know, a review in the New York Times comes up, it's like it's not connected to me.
Mm.
You know? Like, what did I do, you know, to warrant Janet Maslin writing about me?
Well, you know, she's been a fan since the beginning, and I had a few quibbles with her latest review of the third book. But you know, that's just me trying to defend my guy, my writer, Joe Ede. But you know, don't be criticizing my man. Anyway, she did make a note in there that I tend to agree with, and I'm wondering what you think about it. She says people should start at the beginning and read the books in order. Do you have any thoughts on that?
I would hope they would.
Yeah.
And I also hope that each book is enough of a standalone so they can jump in where they want. But I would like them to read them in order. I really want them to know his origin story.
Yeah.
You know, how he got to be who he is. A lot of the books in the genre, you know, the characters just show up fully formed. And we never get to know how they acquired their skills. And, you know, I always think, you know, well, you know, if they're there that smart, why aren't they working for NASA? You know, how do they end up, you know, as a detective?
Uh-huh.
So, yes, I would hope that the readers would start from the beginning.
Well, it is important, I think, to understand Isaiah's relationship with his brother, which you really detail in the first two books. And, in fact, in the third book, amazingly enough, a guy who's very much involved with his brother's story turns up again. And I was pleasantly shocked to see this guy.
I guess you're referring to Seb.
That guy, yeah. I didn't even want to say who he is, but yeah, that guy.
They have a beef.
Uh-huh.
And I wanted to continue that beef until the end. It was unresolved and righteous. And so I wanted to finish that off before I started another sort of Moriarty that would run for longer than one book.
Moriarty. I guess we need to start at the beginning and just put a little framework up for our listeners who aren't familiar with these books. My guest is Joe Ede. His new IQ novel is Wrecked. It just came out. Let's go back to the beginning without spoiling it for people that want to start at the beginning and tell us who is this guy, IQ?
Isaiah is an unlicensed underground private detective, and he takes the cases that the police won't get involved with, small cases that involve the neighborhood. You know, my kid run away. My brother's involved with a drug dealer. I know my husband didn't commit suicide, and you know the police set me up. These kinds of cases he takes when nobody else will, and he gets paid with whatever the whatever the client can pay, which may be something like blueberry muffins, you know, or fixing the roof. And Isaiah's really driven by his past. You know, he's done some terrible things in his life. And so every case he takes is penance. Every case is a way to pay down a debt that can never really be paid off. In the end, they're about a young man and his redemption, about how he overcomes the terrible things in his past and brings justice to people who would not ordinarily have access to justice.
And a moment ago, you mentioned the name Moriarty, and I guess maybe we should explain to listeners why that name means something to you.
Professor Moriarty was Sherlock Holmes, the original Sherlock Holmes. Moriarty was Sherlock's nemesis, and it was a terrific battle of wits because the professor was as smart as Isaiah, and he was somebody you followed through the books and wondered where their next encounter would be. And so I will try to establish a Moriarty every few books. I mean, there was Seb in the first three, and then I'll try and find some other bad guy to take that sort of central role through the next couple of two or three novels.
My guest is Joe Ide. His book is Wrecked. You're listening to 91.3 WYSO, giving voice to our community, our nation, and our world since 1958. Okay, he's got a Moriarty. IQ also has a Watson, and his name actually kind of rhymes with Watson.
Yes, not unintentionally either.
Okay. I love this guy. He's very different from Watson, though.
Yes. You know, there's the old adage, conflict, story is conflict. And I wanted a fractious relationship. You know, I didn't want the overawed, submissive sort of sidekick. And I thought that being almost antagonists would bring just more tension, more interest to it, and was also, it seemed to me, a way to bring in more humor, to have an odd couple.
Mm-hmm.
And so Dodson was born. He's sort of a combination of every hustler I ever knew. And I'm an Aaron Sorkin fan, and so he talks. His dialogue is probably the primary way I reveal his character and differentiate him from every other homeboy in the hood.
Hmm. There's a Scottish writer named Malcolm Mackay who writes about crime syndicates in Glasgow. But the guy lives on a remote island, and as far as I can tell, he never goes to Glasgow. And you just mentioned hustlers and all the hustlers you've known, because you've known a few. I guess we should probably tell our listeners who you are and where you came from.
I grew up in South Central Los Angeles, in an area that was full of crime, gangs, all the inherent problems of the hood. My grandparents lived there because it was close to Little Tokyo, and my family lived with them because we were just getting by. The vast majority of my friends were black. And so me and my brothers, we we co-opted, you know, their speech, style, attitudes, musical taste, all that stuff. And so that really was, that's how I identified myself. I mean, I really wished I was black. You know, I wasn't very convincing, but that was really my world. And so when I thought about writing a novel, there was only one environment that I was so comfortable with that I knew I could write about it. And that's the kind of setting I created for Isaiah, a down and out neighborhood. And that was largely minority populated. And It just seemed like a natural to me. I didn't really think about it. And because I love Sherlock, Sherlock in the Hood seemed like a good idea. That was the only idea I had. Vic, it wasn't like I was choosing.
Well, it was a good idea. As Wrecked opens, you have a prologue. And for someone like me who's read the first two books, to read the prologue, I said to myself, man, this is so dark. What is going on here? And then we get to the end of the prologue, and we just go, oh, my. We just and then we just start ripping the pages. I mean, we're just we can't stop at that point. You set it up so beautifully. Tell us about the basic idea of the story. What's going on here? We've got some very hardened criminals.
Yeah, the idea for the book really started with a young woman named Grace, who Isaiah met in the previous book, Righteous. He was very, very intrigued with her, but she wanted nothing to do with him. And in Wrecked, she comes back to him as a client, which he's a little smug about. And Grace is looking for her mother. Her mother has disappeared 10 years ago. And then just recently, Grace saw her, very brief glimpse of her. And that's why she goes to Isaiah to help her find her mother. Unbeknownst to her mother, Sarah, has photographs of CIA officers, military intelligence, at Abu Ghraib doing terrible things. And she's blackmailing these people from Abu Ghraib and with the pictures. So they are hunting for her, as well as Isaiah and Grace. And these guys are from Abu Ghraib. And there are five of them. And I chose them as bad guys because I was trying to come up with bad guys who were skilled and dangerous, but also, you know, something a little different, something a spark that would make them, you know, even more venal. And that's basically the story. These two sides trying to find Sarah and Sarah's life constantly in danger.
Can we say that their boss was ex-CIA and that he's like the most despicable person that ever lived, except that he loves his family. He loves his family.
Yes. Yes.
What a disconnect.
It is the only human thing about him, but I try and do that no matter who the character is. I try and give them some sense of humanity. And to ground them, we've seen so many bad guys that are just bad, and I always want to give a sense of I want the reader to be able to relate to them in some small way, because readers invest in a character because they have the same issues. You know, the specifics are not the same, but they can identify even with the bad guy and see how powerful his motivation is just beyond the obvious. And that makes, I think, the confrontations more interesting when you've got two parties, both, and you know both motivations, you know, as opposed to something like, you know, get the money, you know, find the killer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, thanks for not making me like him.
Anytime, Vic.
I appreciate that. I kind of liked, like Jimenez, I kind of liked him a little bit.
Yeah.
Because he's
the most self-aware.
Yeah, he keeps mouthing off. And then the dirty cop, the ex-cop, I actually kind of liked him a little bit too, in a sort of a weird way. He's not a nice guy, but I kind of liked him.
Yeah, he is melancholy and really resentful for all kinds of reasons, and you're really battered by his past.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, he has that, you have some sympathy for him, but he really is a bad guy.
You're listening to The Book Nook. We'll be right back. Joe Ide joins us. We're talking about his third IQ novel. It's called Wrecked. It just came out. And I guess if I had to pick a favorite peripheral character, it's a no-brainer in this one. It's a guy named Junior, and it's just because of the way you have him speak. You really had fun with him, didn't you?
Junior's one of my favorites. He really does terrible things to the English language. And he's an exaggeration of people that I knew.
Oh, really?
Who would have these big vocabularies, and they didn't quite know what the words meant. And so they would come off as being, you know, really pompous and pretentious. And I wanted to, I wanted Junior to be that character. He's a drug dealer. But I want to give all my characters something different, some quirk that will make them stand out. And that's what I chose for Junior.
We are also rewarded for reading the earlier books, because you like to drop in references or items from the previous books. And I was very delighted to see that you've brought back a burglary tool, a particularly blunt burglary tool that it was great to see it back in action.
Yeah, I look for ways to connect the books and to provide this sense of a world. And I want that world to continue from book to book. And that's one of the devices I used to connect book three with book one.
Is there a book four being written right now or already written?
It's written. The initial draft is written, and my editor and I will start editing very soon.
Uh-huh. Once you get done with your book tour, I assume you're on a book tour of some kind.
Yeah, I'm running around. But it's fun.
So I think
it's fun to get out of the house.
I think the first book, you weren't touring. You said something like, well, you know, what if nobody shows up?
Yes.
Yeah.
And people frequently didn't. I mean, I did small events.
Uh-huh.
And but mostly Little Brown paired me up with someone or put me on a panel.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I wasn't solo very much. But they eventually had confidence in me, and so they send me to speak and they send me to teach, and you know, it's great to get out of the house and get some attention, but there's such a thing as too much attention.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm relieved when the touring season is over.
Well, Joe, I'm a person that pays attention to what things that seem like coincidences, and I thought it was interesting that your publication date was the same date as the new book by John Sanford. I thought that was very interesting, Joe. Are you guys doing anything together? I know you have in the past.
We aren't, at least nothing that I know of now, and I'm very sorry about that. One of the first things I did with IQ was an appearance at a bookstore called Poison Pen in Scottsdale, Arizona.
Uh-huh.
And it's a very influential bookstore, and especially in terms of the crime genre. And John Sanford asked for me.
Uh-huh.
to appear with him. And it was a very, very kind gesture. And so I had, you know, people came to see John Sanford, tons of them, but also got a chance to see me. And that was John's intention. It was a really nice thing to do, and I'm sorry that we weren't able to connect this time, because we did do an event for the first two books.
Well, he's the guy who, before your first book came out, I asked him. I said, "Well, give me some tips, something that's hot that I should read." And he goes, "Oh man, you got to read this new one." And sure enough, he was spot on, and he turned me on to you. So I appreciate that.
Yes, I have many things to thank John for.
My guest is Joe Eday, and your publicist sent a little press sheet along with the book. And it says something here which I thought was pretty amazing, and I was pleased to see it. And I thought back to your first interview where you talked about how you tried to be a screenwriter, and it was just like you're beating your head against the wall. And now this publicity material saying something about people bidding for IQ to turn into a TV series. Is this real?
Yes. There's a producer, Atlas Films, and the actual studio, Alcon, and they're working to put put IQ on as a series.
Wow.
And like everything in TV and movies, it's going very slowly.
Yeah.
Very slowly. And that's just the nature of the beast. And so hopefully they'll have a pilot written in a few months. And they've been kind enough to let me consult and sit in on the meetings and hear what I have to say, which is not the ordinary way of things.
Well, that's respect.
I guess so.
Uh-huh.
I guess so.
That's respect. Oh, that's great. Congratulations.
Thank you very much.
And we hope to see something come out of the other end of the pipe sometimes. I know these things, like you say, they're slow. And if they were having a bidding war, it sounds to me like whoever got the prize is going to be interested in making this come to fruition.
They are very interested. I mean, they're certainly excited about it and really do like the books, and they think they're different, and they're really intent upon putting a good show together. And I'm glad.
You have some fun peripheral characters in here besides that drug dealer I mentioned, and a couple of my other favorites are these two women, Dodson's former business partner and Dodson's current partner in love and life and the mother of his child. This former business partner, she's great.
Duranda.
Uh-huh.
Duranda is a homegirl through and through. And she was based on my first girlfriend, Stephanie Farrington, who lived two doors down. And I think I was 10 and she was 11. And Stephanie was a head and a half taller than me and weighed me by 30 pounds. My brother said that when we held hands, she looked like a ventriloquist with a Japanese dummy, which I thought was a little harsh, but that's probably true. And Stephanie, I got Duranda's attitude from her. That's who Duranda was based on.
Well, Joe, thanks for explaining that description by your brother, because I think it gives our listeners an inkling of the fact that these books are very funny. And this new one, I was laughing. I mean, we have these serious criminals and serious bad stuff going on, yet the dialogue and some of the stuff that happens is so funny. It's really a relief when you're reading about people being tortured to have a little comic element in there to sort of counterbalance that.
Yes, that was the intent. And I really try and go for that. I really try and go for terrifying funny, intense funny, dramatic funny, disturbing funny. You're right. I mean, it is a break, and I wanted the books to be, you know, within the paradigms of a thriller. On the other hand, this sort of relentless doom and action just gets sort of wearing after a while, you know. And it's something that I, when I was a screenwriter, I wrote primarily comedy. And so it came sort of naturally to look for ways to find the books, find humorous things in the books.
Particularly Dodson. Dodson really is the comedian in this. And you are a longtime admirer of stand-up comedy. I think in our first interview you talked about how as a kid you had a big stack of comedian record albums. Red Fox,
yes.
Richard Pryor, you love that stuff.
Yes, I was a really unfunny kid and a really sort of anonymous fringe kid. And humor just seemed like a way to stand out. And there were so many, you know, funny people in the neighborhood, and I just fell in love with black comedians. And I would listen to them relentlessly. And I never became especially funny myself, but I came to appreciate the humor.
Come on, your book is funny. Maybe you just have to write it down. Maybe you're not real good at telling the joke, and you have a funny little thing in your book where someone's supposed to tell a joke, and IQ's like, I don't know how to tell a joke. And she doesn't know how to tell a joke either. His girlfriend, I hate to call her the girlfriend, but she kind of is his girlfriend.
Yeah. I wanted to make their relationship as awkward as possible. You know, he's isolated, shy, has very few social skills. And I thought it would be more interesting to have, you know, a love interest who was the same. And, you know, again, there's the adage, you know, story is conflict. And I thought that would be a really tormented but fun way, you know, to write about a relationship.
I'm not going to say anything about who this character is, but you do have a character in here who runs a bookstore. We find that out near the end of the story. And I really like this character, too. He's got a soul. He's just an old lefty.
Right. Yes.
Oh, I like that guy. Thanks for bringing him in.
You're welcome. You're welcome.
I'm guessing he's modeled on someone else you knew.
Yeah, I mean, he's kind of a child of the 60s and 70s.
Uh-huh.
And I thought that was another attitude I can put into the mix that would be different and would conflict with everybody else.
Recently, I went back into my archive and I pulled out an interview I did 20 years ago with James Lee Burke, and I'd forgotten what he talked about in that interview, but mm-hmm. I was reminded of it when I was reading your book because he described being a social worker in South Central in the 1960s and the gangs that were around. And I didn't realize until I started reading some of the press material about you that you're a little bit older than I thought you were, and this would have been at the same time that you were there. There were all these gangs that are gone now.
Yeah, except there are a few Latino gangs that are still there several generations later. But yeah, there was a lot of gangs around, and it was, you know, a relatively dangerous place to live. But the other thing was, it was before everybody had a gun,
mm-hmm.
and you know, if there was a fight, it was a fist fight, and you know, people would jump around, box around, do their Muhammad Ali impression, somebody get their nose broken, and everybody would go home.
Yeah.
You know, and it's just so much different now, as you know.
Well, I don't know, actually. I've never been to South Central, and I think I'm probably going to stay away. But my guess is Joe Ide.
There are better tourist spots than.
Yeah. I think I'll go to Grumman's Chinese Theater instead.
I think that's a better choice.
Okay. Joe Ide has been my guest. His book is Wrecked. We have just enough time. I like the fact that you're seasoned, Joe. That you've been around, that you've had life experience. You've had a lot of weird jobs, haven't you? Can you tell our listeners some of the jobs you've had?
The first real job I had was as a school teacher, grades 4 through 6. It was one of those open area kind of classrooms where everybody was all in the same room. And I was there about 2 weeks when I discovered I didn't like kids. You know.
Yeah.
You know, they were, you know, fussy and noisy, and they kept asking me questions. I was a terrible teacher, uh-huh. for sure. It was awful. And so I was there for, I think a semester, and then I left. And then I just went from job to job. I was middle manager in a big corporation, and I was human resources someplace else, and I was a business consultant, and I wrote technical stuff for different companies, and when I was struggling as a screenwriter, I had odd jobs, I ran an answering service that was staffed completely by transsexuals.
Wow!
And I managed a big, huge apartment complex where pretty much everybody was an immigrant from somewhere. And things like that. So I just bopped around for a long time until I decided to write the novel.
Well, you are well seasoned, Joe, and we really appreciate you coming back on the show. And good luck with everything. And we'll be watching for the fourth book.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Vic.
And that was Joe Ide talking about his new IQ novel. It's called Wrecked, and it is a good one. And we have a little extra time for you today on the program, and we're going to dip into our Book Nook archive and pull out an interview that I did back in 1996 with the late J. California Cooper. She joined us just once on the program to talk about a collection of short stories called Some Love, Some Pain, Some Time. And we'll bring you J. California Cooper, a very special conversation with her right after this. You're listening to the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO, segueing from our new interview with Joe Ide to an interview I did back in 1996 with J. California Cooper. That was her pen name. Her name was Joan Cooper, and she died a few years ago. Back in 1996, she had been on book tour. She came through Dayton to talk about a collection of short stories, and I was able to interview her before she left town about this book. It's called Some Love, Some Pain, Some Time. Here's J. California Cooper on the Book Nook.
Tell us about yourself, your career, how you got to this place.
Well, that's not so very interesting, but I got to this place because I always liked to write. I was telling stories before I could write. I played with paper dolls till I was 18 because I liked the dialogue and making up stories. My mother took them away from me, and consequently I had to start writing them down. And that's how I started with plays, and then Alice Walker came in one day to a community theater and saw the plays and said, "Would you turn these into short stories?" And I said, "Yes." And I was so glad to be able to do something that took less work than plays that I was thrilled because I had no idea I could write anything, much less, you know. So anyway, then they published the short stories, and then St. Martin saw them and bought them, and then Doubleday is one of the next books, and so that's where I am now. But I do have a place where I started. I have a personal self that's mine, and myself is a Bible student. And I like the truth, and I like wisdom. And when I was a little girl, I used to say to my mother, "I want to go outside and play. Everybody's having fun, and I never have any fun." And she said, "Listen, any fool can have some fun. You come in this house and learn some sense." And there was always a book in the house, and so I learned to love books. Now, I like wisdom. I love wisdom because I knew when I was little, this is the truth I'm telling you. This is what I went through. When I was little and I made little mistakes and my mother whipped me and I knew my mother loved me, it hurt. It hurt. And somehow I knew as I watched people and grew older that when you get out in this world and you make mistakes and the world whips you, sometimes you never get up. So then I loved wisdom more. And so that is what was always interested me. So when it came time to start writing stories, that's what came out. And being a Bible student, it was the truth. And so I don't lie in my books. I really try to tell these people, not that I'm so smart, but I try to say to them, "Look, just look at what you're doing a little bit closer if you're not happy and see what's wrong." There is something that I have that brings to a point why I write what I write. If I have time.
You sure do.
Now, I don't have it. The paper's gone down with my suitcases to the car, but I remember as much as possible, and I read this before every reading to the people I'm talking to. This was put on a tombstone by a caliph, which is like a king of Spain, many years ago. Now, to me, if you put something on your tombstone, you're not going to gain anything else from lying, so it might as well be the truth, and I don't think he lied. Bear with me. I'm going to remember it. He said, and this will bring why I write what I write. He said, "I have now reigned 50 years in liberty, in wartime, and peace. I have been beloved by my subjects and respected by my allies and feared by my enemies." Let me see. "Honor and glory, everything has followed him all his life. Pleasure, riches, everything has followed him all his life, has been waiting on his call. He has done without nothing. During this life of wonder, I have kept count of the days that have been given me. They number 14. Well, I said, "My God, this man has everything that the world says we need to be happy, and he got 14 days. And I thought of all the other people in the world who do not have all these things to work with. And how many days of happiness do they get? And then it came to me, as you think about things, we have to understand that you need some money, but money should not be the goal for your happiness, because even rich people commit suicide. And Shakespeare was right when he said, 'Uneasy lies the head that has the power.'" You know what? I forget the whole thing. "Uneasy lies the head that has the power," anyway, "that wears the crown." Mm-hmm. So now we know it's not power, which we know anyway. So if it's not those two things, you have to find out what it is in your life, your special life alone. You get these little 30, 40, 50, 60 years, maybe 80, and you have to decide what you're going to do with them to have some happiness in your life. You cannot pay attention to the Joneses because they lie a lot. You have to find out what it is to you in your heart. And so this is what brings down why I write what I write. I'm trying to say, look, you have choices. Make yourself all the choices you can. Like, that's what an education is for. Find out what you can want, what you can do, what it means to you. Look at your family and find out about values if possible. Everybody's not born with a smart mother or a smart father. You have to do it sometime. And you have to do it in order to have a life of any value here while you're on earth. And then I'm not going to talk you to death, but that's the gist of what my stories are about.
We are happy to hear your words. My guest is Jay California Cooper, and her most recent book is Some Love, Some Pain, Some Time. It's a book of short stories. Now, did this just come out in the paperback version?
Yes. Yes, it did.
Okay. And the thing I've noticed about your stories, you condense so much into so few pages. The story, for instance, Living Without a Life, about Audrey.
Yeah.
You really cover her life, and yet you do it in such a short amount of time. It's an incredible story.
She made me so angry sometime because I kept waiting for her, because I let my characters run their own life. I want to see what they're going to do. And when it rains, these stories come, and when it sunshines, I don't get anything. But I let them run their life because I know teachers say you must always know your character and you must make a list of what kind of, but you know what? You don't even know yourself. So I don't know my characters until they get through. But she made me so just kind of angry, not angry, because she did everything for other people. She lived their lives all the time. When she first got married, she got that little second job. She sent her husband to college. I think that's wonderful, but get him to get a second job or vice versa and send both of you to college. Because when he got through, there was nothing he could talk to her about, and he left her for someone else. And then she was on this treadmill of trying to find some way to be happy again. And, you know, she made me so mad. Not until the end did she finally get up and do something with herself. You know, and I do like people. This is survival. You cannot fool around here and wait. The name of this game is Truth or Consequences. And you can't wait till the end to find out, well, how am I made him happy. Maybe you should make yourself happy, too. You know what I mean?
I sure do.
I don't mean to sound like I'm fussing, but I am a mother, and that's the way I talk.
Well, I think of my own mother when I read some of these stories. So many women sacrifice their lives to help others, to live through others, to live through their man, to live through their children. And this happens a lot in your stories. Do you see the roles of women changing?
Well, I want to be very explicit about that. I am a Bible student. I write under the Ten Commandments. And in God's infinite wisdom, he said the Ten Commandments. He did not label them for men. That means just as many men suffer under these things as women do. It's an equal thing. Nobody is perfect. And every story I write, you can turn it around and the man is the protagonist or the antagonist, whatever, because we are too much alike that one is getting all the good and one is perfect. None of them are perfect. And that is why I treat them equal in my books. I do think some people give up too much for other people that always do not love them like they should or like they deserve. And I think that one ought to wake up and say to themselves, well, I love you and you love me. Now, if I love you all by myself, then I better go ahead and love myself all by myself until somebody comes along, if you know what I mean. You know what I mean?
I think I'm catching your drift, California.
Okay.
My guest is Jay California Cooper, and her latest book, which just came out in a soft cover version, it's a book of short stories called Some Love, Some Pain, Some Time. It sounds like Alice Walker more or less discovered you.
She did. She came to the theaters where they were putting on my plays, and she liked them, and she asked me to turn them into short stories. Well, I had so many ideas running around in my head, I didn't need to turn those plates because I had people waiting in line to come out, you know. And so I just said, I'll do 12 stories. And it was so much easier than writing a play with all the directions and left stage and right stage and her elbow and up in her head. You know, you don't have to do that in a short story. And you're right. They do move fast because I can say anyhow and skip over 5 years. But that's because everybody knows what happened already. You know, they do know. You don't have to tell them line for line. Then she went to the store and she got this. You know, you don't have to do that. They know what she did.
Uh-huh. You must have a very keen eye for observing people around you. We have so many fascinating things going on all the time, other people's lives, our lives, and yet so often people just don't even notice.
That is the truth. That is the truth. I had an acquaintance once whose husband died of cancer. And she said to me after the funeral, she said, I didn't even know he was sick. I didn't have the same respect for her after, or maybe not any. Because to me, if you don't know what's going on around you, when my cat gets sick, I know it. I know it. So if you are in a house with someone you liked enough to stay in a house with, why don't you know what's happening? How are you going to protect your happiness if you don't pay attention to what's affecting it? You know, I just said, my golly, what could she have been thinking of? You don't have to give your total attention, but a piece of your heart is involved. Don't you see what's happening? And I guess I don't pay more attention than some people I do, because I want to know. This affects my life, the quality of my life. Yes, I want to know what's going on around me. I depend on it. You know what I mean? I hate to keep saying that, but I know I talk quick sometime, you know.
I think most of us understand what you're talking about, and
okay.
It's refreshing to hear what you're saying, so don't worry about it.
Okay.
My guest is Jay California Cooper, and she is just now leaving the Miami Valley after a couple of appearances in bookstores, and I understand that you've had a long few weeks on the road. What are you going to do when you get home?
Well, I'm going to go home. I have 3 days only, you see, because I've gotten to the age that I finally made my publisher know that I'm not going to stay on the road all that time. All this gray hair stands for something. So, therefore, I'm going home for 3 days, and then I start out again Friday, and I'm into some of the southern states, I think Mississippi, Tennessee, and Alabama, and then on to Boston, and New York, and Washington, D.C., and Florida. And I will get home on the 28th. These are not my favorite things to do beyond tour. You meet a lot of nice people, and you see strange places, but I got roommates at home, you know. I got a bird and two cats, and they wonder where in the world I am because they don't read. So, therefore, you know, I'm dying to get home to my home, you know. I got flowers waiting for me, you know, to be watered. Like, nobody's going to love them like me, you know, that kind of thing. But on the other hand, you have to go, and you're lucky that somebody cares enough about your book to put you on a tour.
Well, I'm sure your animal friends miss you as much as miss them.
Yes, much as I miss them.
Where do you live?
In Oakland, California. That's my home. I was born in Berkeley, and I moved to Texas for several years to get away from distractions, but the heat ran me out of Texas. I could not take it any longer, so I went back home to the ocean, and so that's where I am right now. And I'm planning to move again soon because there's too much going on in Oakland, too much noise, too much cursing, too much everything. And so I'm going further up the California coast toward Oregon, which is Eureka. And then I can settle down and write some more. Oh, I'm so eager to get to work doing some things I really want to do of my own. I'm very lucky Doubleday lets me do what I want to do.
I've heard Eureka is absolutely beautiful.
Oh, they say that trees and little water and space.
Well, there's something about the Bay Area. People that live there have a hard time living anywhere else. I understand how Texas was too hot because...
Man, it's hot. People cook at 5 o'clock in the morning just so they don't have to turn their stove on the rest of the day, and that's too much.
My guest is Jay California Cooper. Her book is Some Love, Some Pain, Some Time. She's also written In Search of Satisfaction. How many books have you written?
Seven. Two novels and 5 short story books. I love short stories. But the novels are good, too. Listen, I love them all. I love all these people. I read my work sometime. I get in it because I'm checking on something someone asked me, and I get involved. I love these people because they're living. They're living. I think anyone that sits down and says, well, I know we have nothing to do, I think you're a fool. You're a fool. If you're in this big world with all these wonderful things to do and you don't have nothing to do, you're not paying attention. And listen, if you walk around, forgive me for saying this, but this is what I have to say to people. If you walk around too much with too many wrinkles in your brow and you're not happy with your life, I want you to know it is your fault. If it has nothing to do with health, because you can't control health, but everything else, if you're not happy, it's kind of your fault. You need to take a check on yourself, because life is not doesn't have to be miserable. You're not going to be happy all the time, but that would be too much anyway. But you should be happy most of the time, because this is your choice. Your choice, your life, your body, your mind. And people shouldn't run it who don't have sense enough to make you happy.
Well,
as much as possible. Excuse me.
That's okay. I hate to interrupt you.
That's all right. That's all right.
I haven't been around probably quite as long as you. I've been around a little bit. I live in a small town. And you really notice some people almost always have a smile, and some people never have a smile. And you almost feel like going up to them and grabbing them by the shirt and shaking them and saying, I'll bet you have a great smile. I'd love to see it sometime.
And you want to tell them, listen, do you know that smile reaches down all through your stomach and down to you feel good when you smile. You do feel good when you smile. I think, you know what, I love as much as possible. I do not only love people, some of them, but I like the rest, you know, because I keep people at a distance. Too many people don't know what they're doing, and I don't want them to do it on me. But I love flowers and rocks and clouds and butterflies and birds and even, you know, spiders. I don't kill them. I scoop them up in a bag and put them outside. They have a right to life. I love things. I love colors and music and books. Love everything that you can, because love is a beautifying thing, better than a vitamin. And it shows, and your skin glows, and your heart glows, and that's the most important thing. Love things. And don't always compare, like, what's better, what's better. Get what you like. Get what you like. That's what's the best. And you know, just, and also share some. Share some. People are always telling people, you have no self-esteem, but they don't know, and they don't tell you how you get self-esteem. You get self-esteem by doing things you are proud of. Share some. With someone who can't help themselves. Buy some shoes for that little boy that has none. Do something. Pat that little boy's head and his shoulder whose mother doesn't come home or whose father is gone or someone whose parents just died. Reach out, because, you know, you can still take yourself home all by yourself. Nobody's going to bother you. But reach out and just let somebody know you care. You'd be surprised what that does for people and you.
You've been listening to the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO, my 1996 interview with J. California Cooper. And that's the only interview I ever had with her. She had come through Dayton on book tour, and we caught her before she left the area and headed back to California. And we talked about her collection of short stories, which had just come out that year. And it was really a great collection called Some Love, Some Pain, Some Time. And she had been discovered by Alice Walker. And she had encouraged Cooper to turn from plays to writing short stories. And Alice once said of her, in its strong folk flavor, Cooper's work reminds us of Langston Hughes and Zora Neale Hurston. Like theirs, her style is deceptively simple and direct. And the veil of tears in which her characters reside is never so deep that a rich chuckle at a foolish person's foolishness cannot be heard. I loved her viewpoint. I loved the way she spoke. And she died in 2014 at the age of 82. And in 1989, she won the American Book Award. And really, an amazing woman, and I was so glad to be able to pull that cassette out and digitize it and bring you that excerpt for the Best of the Book Nook. Did you know, if you go to our website, that we have about 500 author interviews available that you can listen to as podcasts anytime you choose? That's a lot of author interviews. Go to the Book Nook page at wyso.org and check them out. And did you know that the Book Nook comes your way every weekend on Saturday morning at 7, like today, and on Sunday morning at 10:30, a totally different interview on Sunday morning than the one you heard on Saturday? Tune in tomorrow when I'll be talking to the author of one of the hottest books of the fall. His name is Lou Burney. His book is called November Road. It's set in 1963, right before the Kennedy assassination. John F. Kennedy shot in Dallas. And he has an alternate explanation for how that happened. A gangster in New Orleans orchestrated the assassination, but that's just part of the story in November Road, which is going to be turned into a movie. We'll be talking to Lou Burney tomorrow at 10:30 in the Book Nook for November Road. You've been listening to the Book Nook on WYSL. For the Book Nook, I'm Vic McInnes.